back in the 60s, considered it briefly.
Yeah, those
for the
were
Cardinal, and then
experimented
later
with Thunderbird.
Thunderbird,
Yeah.
But somehow they got lost by the wayside.
Well, they were expensive. Number one, our plants were not designed to produce front-wheel drive engines and transmissions, and there wasn't any real need to do it. So we didn't.
You've taken full hold then of the light car section of the design studio this time. Is there a change in direction in terms of the establishment of the North American design project here?
Well, what
within
happened?
The design studio?
Yeah, the
center rather.
As you remember, North American operations was losing money. We weren't making money for what, several years. We were breaking even, losing money, and Ford of Europe was making money, seemed to be doing everything correctly, not only in the market, but their products, and they seemed to have hit on the right way of doing it. And along with Mr. Iacocca leaving the company, the new team and management decided that what would be best for all of us product-wise would be to go European, copy the things that were successful in Europe. And so they were putting people in the key jobs that had European and overseas experience so that they could work together better as a team. They knew what needed to be done and how it was done. And that's when the design activity was really divided. So, that was another thing that Red Poling insisted upon, was that the design group or people doing his cars reported directly to him and not to the president.
Is this is when he was...
When he was in Europe, that's the way it was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he thought that was a better teamwork approach. He didn't want to come over and run North American operations and have the design activity reporting to another group, because he couldn't see that ever becoming successful. And maybe it was a dilemma, but I thought it was a plus. I still think that you need to have the opportunity to do your own thinking a little bit. But anyway.
In a coordinated effort.
Right. So the design office was divided so that North American operations had its own design group. And it's been that way since, 3 years now?
Yes. You mentioned Bill Burke. Was he brought along to head up about this time the North American automotive operations?
Bill Burke came from Ford of Europe about 1977 or something.
Right. About that time, huh?
Because the first cars he worked on were the 79 Ford Mercurys.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked on those for him. And he had some very strong opinions about what those cars should be. He was a little bit torn between whether they should be European or American. And I think we probably hit it about right. They weren't quite as American as the Americans were before that, but they were not as European as I think he would have liked them in the beginning. Unfortunately, the 79 or 80, we also did the Lincolns and the Mark then too. We downsized. See, these were all downsized cars.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This was some of the very beginning downsized years.
Right.
And his goal on the Lincoln in particular was you downsize the Lincoln, you don't lose any of its cues, you don't let the buyer realize that you've shortened it and changed it, and the rear seat had to be bigger than it was the year before. Now that's a tough assignment.
These are marketing considerations.
Oh yeah.
You have to translate into design decisions.
So he wanted to sell the guy a car that weighed less, got better fuel economy, but was larger than the car he had before that. interior dimension, which was a tough assignment. And that's a little bit why the roof on today's Lincoln is so big.
Mm.
It's longer, and it's got a short deck and a short hood.
Mm.
But that's how it happened.
Well, after a short period of working with mid-sized cars, you were firmly back into the small car design area, and that appears to have been your area.
That's where I've been since.
Yeah. So, let's take you from about 1978 and bring you forward slowly as to exactly what projects you worked on during that period.
Okay, well, I worked on the 79 and 80 Ford Mercurys and Lincolns and Marks.
Mm-hmm.
And we did those all for Bill Burke. And then shortly after that, I was assigned doing all the small cars and mid-sized cars and trucks. And we were downsizing in every area, including trucks. The biggest truck project at the time was the Ranger program. And I worked a little bit on the downsizing of the big F series, but the biggest project I worked on there was the Ranger. And by the way, the company was very apprehensive about that, because the plans called for, if you read the projected buying scope, that nobody would ever buy big trucks again in the next 5 years. We would just stop building those, and so the whole plan on the Ranger was to make that truck look as beefy and strong and as brother-like to the big one as we could make it. So that we didn't want this man to come from the big one down and be unhappy. And we also had to get the foreign guy who was buying the smaller ones to want something a little bit bigger. So it was a tough assignment in a way. So that was a very interesting assignment. And then in the car side, we were heavily into Escort. That was probably our biggest project.
It had been a success in Europe, had it not?
Well, we were working together on it.
Ah.
Ford of Europe was working on Escort, so were we. Don Peterson couldn't understand why we needed two cars that really could do one and answer both markets. And we tried desperately to make it one car for a while. And I guess it was proven that it really didn't pay out. And I think, in the end, I think we have, two common parts between us and Europe. But
sounds like Peterson was following the old McNamara principle.
Somewhat, but
interrelating components.
Yeah.
Models.
Yeah, somewhat to that old philosophy, and I guess there's some good in all that. But the thing that brought that on, Dave, was that he looked across at Honda, and he said, "You know, Honda doesn't do two cars for Europe and America. They sell the same car. So why can't we?" And we're trying to do more of that now. We're trying to get down to basically one common car, if we can, between countries. So we were doing Escorts, and then along after the Escort, the need to do a car a little bit bigger than Escort, front-wheel drive, we took on the Temple Topaz program.
Before we get to that, I'd like to go back a bit to the Escort. Apparently a break with, maybe not to designers and engineers, but to the buying public, it was a break with the previous Ford products and presaged a period of what seemed to the buying public a rather experimental period for Ford. Can you give us some of the background in terms of design decisions that were made in that era?
I'm trying to think how to answer that. Well, we were trying to get the public to look at Ford as a different, new company that was doing more aerodynamic cars that were, you could call them more European-influenced in appearance, better fuel economy, better engineered, better fit and finish. And we really did. We designed our cars from the very beginning stage to do a better job of manufacturing. Less requirements for precision fits and so forth. But we took on a new look in our cars that we thought the box, the stiff look of the late 70s and 80s was over. We wanted to get the public to realize that a new era had taken over in the company. And I think we've done that on our projects, programs. I think the very first car, maybe there was a little bit of an Escort, but not a lot. But the Thunderbird was our very first car that we concentrated heavily on in that manner. And of course, Coupe.
The Thunderbird is one of your biggest recent success stories. Can you give us a little bit of a feeling how that developed in the late 70s? I understand, am I correct, mm-hmm. that Jean Bordonnais had a hand in that mm-hmm. just before he left?
Yes.
And, could you sort of wrap that up as sort of a package like you did with the Mustang?
Well, the Thunderbird was interesting because we didn't really want to go through the same process that we'd used when we did the 80. The 1980 Thunderbird was designed on a completely different package. It was smaller. And along came marketing at the last minute and decided that it had to be more of a formal car. They wanted to get the premium buyer in the Ford Division store. And so we had to formalize the car almost at the last minute. We had to put the grill in straight. We had to put a formal roof on it. We had to increase the deck lid, the luggage compartment. And it became boxy almost overnight. And we definitely didn't want to go through that.
It was a silent disaster.
It almost did, really. And it happens to you so gradual and so slow, you don't really see it. And I guess maybe that's all of our faults for not catching it. But when we started this Thunderbird, we elected to really set those parameters at the beginning and inform everybody the type of car we wanted to do and start designing the aerodynamic look and change from box to flow lines and shapes. And we wanted to make this car look dramatically different, attract a different buyer, and get back into an exciting Thunderbird again. So that's how that happened, and I think it was a good move that we made. We then, in fact, really, the Tempo Topaz, which really didn't come out until a year later, was preceding the Thunderbird in design and influenced the Thunderbird a lot. Mm. But we were really working on the Tempo Topaz before the Bird, and we're the ones that put the limousine-type doors on, mm-hmm. and then they picked it up for the Thunderbird. So continued the same aerodynamic look on the Topaz, even though that market in our market research didn't really tell us that it was the right thing to do in that market, because that market segment is very status conscious. Their goal in life basically is to drive an Olds 88 or an Olds Cutlass. And so they're looking for a formal looking car with a padded C-pillar and plush big seats. So this market this research really didn't make us feel too comfortable. But we thought we were right, and we thought we should introduce this look that we did. And anyway, we're quite happy we did now. But so that was the beginning of this new series, and then of course the Mark 7 picked it up, and our new Ford Mercury replacement cars are picking it up.
Mm-hmm. Those are coming along
for next year.
Next year.
Yeah.
Will they be completely?
I think they'll be called 86s, I believe.
Will they completely supplant the Topaz Tempo series?
No, they're going to
supplement.
They're planned to replace the big Ford Mercury. But now we're going to keep the big Ford Mercury for another year or two.
You decided to do that because it's doing so well.
Yes.
And that pretty much is the Fairmont platform.
That's right. Yeah.
The let's move back just a moment to administration at this point. You've had a change of concept in terms of splitting up the North American design and the design staff, I believe. And Jean Bourdonnais is still VP for design, but there are some problems developing. Can you would you like to address those in terms of staff and administration? You have a new crop of young men coming up, and
well, I think in all fairness, the management and the company wanted to get our products to take on a different environment, a different look, from not only a design but a look, but an engineering and manufacturing standpoint. And they felt that the old team weren't really capable to do it quickly enough. Not that they weren't good guys, but I think they just felt that starting with a team that had mostly been to Europe, understood it, had worked together there, could do it quicker and achieve it. And so the whole company, I think, took not only in our area, but in marketing, sales, and manufacturing. And I believe that that's the basic reason for doing it. When the design staff part of the in our area was formulated, it was done to take a look at far out trends, work on projects that we couldn't do on a day-to-day basis. And to get it's an education process in design, and I think there's a lot of need to do some education along the way with our top management. And you may think that you can sell them a new thought in 1 minute, but you can't. You got to let them look at it and look at it day after day and get familiar with it. And I think design staff's biggest single role is to do that. And that is they can weed out and help set the trends. And I tried to do that a long time ago with Iacocca to get him to be more familiar and receptive. We decided to put some advanced cars in an area that he would have to walk by. And Bourdonnais thought that was a great idea. So we put these three cars there, and he walked by and said, "I don't like any of those cars, get them out." So they lasted 5 minutes. But
well, in essence, you're saying that as the 70s wound down, there's a feeling that the old design group is getting a bit stodgy and not very as imaginative as they would want them to be.
Well, that's probably true, although that's a little bit harsh to say that, because we don't have any new designers. We still have the same basic people doing the new stuff that did the prior to the 80s or before, including the 80s. I think it was a philosophy that changed in the very top level of the company. I think Mr. Ford's philosophy changed. I think he agreed that we should change our products to be more international. I think Peterson definitely wanted to change them. And in all fairness, I think Iacocca felt strongly that cars with a more formal look about them was easier to attract and get the top dollar. And he was probably instrumental in making them boxier. And
was Bourdonnais an Iacocca advocate at this point?
Definitely, but I'll tell you, Bourdonnais is as flexible as any of us. And he's worked for a lot of regimes, how many presidents he worked for, but I think he could design as flexible as anybody. And I think that they really, in fairness to Gene, didn't give him a chance.
Uh-huh.
He just didn't work in Europe. He did not fit into the red polling way of doing business.
Which was developing then.
Right. And I think Bordenave would have been a little bit argumentative.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want somebody to be that. They wanted someone who would say, I agree, let's go, let's do it, and not sit back and say, well, I'm not so sure, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that was the biggest criteria.
So Gene saw the handwriting on the wall and decided to leave at that point.
Right.
Yes.
Well, he did a lot of cars. You know, as many years as he was in charge, what was it, 18 or 19 years, I think he was growing tired, believe me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he was a very fantastic commercial designer.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably not a more commercial designer living.
Mm-hmm.
Who seemed to be able to know exactly what the public wanted at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So
at that point, then we have the Caldwell Polling European group that is being.
And Peterson
have come into the ascendancy in terms of product planning and product design.
Yep.
So, presumably, you were very much in sympathy with this approach.
Well, I thought it was time for a new look. Believe me, I wasn't looked upon as being European because I had spent too many years with Iacocca.
Mm-hmm.
And worked on too many cars, I guess, with him. And worked on a lot of, in fact, I have never worked overseas.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not looked upon as being the European designer that they were looking for at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't disagree at all that we needed to get a new look,
mm-hmm.
whatever it may be, that we needed to get some fresh thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I joined in and said, let's go and we try some things. And by the way, Bordenave did too.
He was in on the very early discussions.
Sure.
And decisions. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem between Bordenave, and I shouldn't say this on tape, but and Polling and Peterson was with the degree you do it. Whether you go here or somewhere between. And I think if we look back in 10 years, we may find that Bordenave was right.
Mm-hmm.
You never know.
Mm-hmm. Well, the this period, obviously you had much to do with the small car and truck design of the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
You've, in spite of the misgivings over the Ranger, it's been incredible success.
Yeah.
And you've slightly downsized the F series, although you've kept the good solid features of them.
We sure have. We're currently redoing it now almost entirely for 87.
Mm-hmm.
And we're making it dramatically newer and fresher in appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And not losing the twin I-beam and all the strong points that
points
it has.
That you've had, yes.
We're looking at, as you know, an all-new van,
mm-hmm.
called Aerostar.
How's that coming, by the
way? It's coming along slower than I would like, but it's coming along well.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I'm concerned, the design work's all done.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be on the road in about a year,
mm-hmm.
less than a year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a big departure from the vans that we have on the road today. And we're doing some exciting car things. We got brand new, all new Thunderbirds and Cougars for the late 80s and 90s that are just fantastic.
So. Back to the, I'm fascinated by the, you'll forgive me, I'm fascinated by this dichotomy between the NAD and the staff approach.
Yeah.
Don Kopka had come in a little later than you had, I think, and terms, maybe about 10 years later than you had.
He came from Chrysler. Don came from Chrysler. He was in charge, I believe, of Plymouth Studio at Chrysler. Mm-hmm. And joined Ford in what I call the Third Look Studio. Mm-hmm. And the Corporate Projects or something they called it. And was hired in as a supervisor, if I recall. And Don and I worked closely on it. We went through the Ford studio and through interiors almost side by side, so I know his work and he knows mine very well. And I think Don's an excellent choice for that job, by the way. I think he's maybe a little more flexible than I am for dealing with all this that gets thrown at you.
But at that point, you found yourselves on divergent paths, in a sense, that you were heading up you were working with the day-to-day decisions in NAD,
right?
And Don taking the staff position and and being asked to take Bordenay's job when he left,
yeah.
Became, in effect, the advance design chief.
Right.
How does that work, and how does that operate principle work?
Well, on the chart, they do all projects prior to 54 months. So that's out in the area where they determine the philosophy, what the car or the project should be, what market segment it's after. He helps establish size, package, some shapes and forms. He does some. They look at them for concept. He has a studio in Italy, and they do some of the same thing with some Italian influence.
Is that the Ghia?
The Ghia operation. Mm-hmm. They're all brought in and reviewed, and at 54 months, we take them over. And then we hopefully take what they have and use it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we can't, sometimes we can. Mm-hmm. Aerostar was one where his studio started. And the theme generally has stayed. A lot changed on it, but it was pretty much the same thing.
Aerostar would seem to be a perfect example of the of what the advanced planning studio or the advanced design studio, which you've come up with a completely different concept.
Right, right.
And although Chrysler and Volkswagen has beaten you to the market. There's our compromises, which...
Well, Chrysler is closer than what we are, I mean, to the market with us. And the reason, by the way, they did it so fast at Chrysler is because we did it a couple times here for Iacocca and Sperling. And so they knew pretty much what the package should be, the type of vehicle it should be. They had our market research results that all said that the first guy out's going to sell a ton of them, the second guy will sell fewer, and the third guy will sell less. And so they were bound and determined to be first. And Lee even mentioned it, by the way, in a article. He said it was very easy to go to Chrysler and do it because I'd done it a couple times at Ford. And so we are aiming really at the same market with that vehicle. But that's what the staff function really is. And now, we really don't have a good advanced group in NAO design. We tend to almost go directly into production problems. But 54 months gives us a little bit of time. And if the staff cars and the early projects are done well and the company's all behind it, they're really not that big a problem.
So can you, without being specific in detail, can you tell us what the direction of Ford Steiner will be in the next, say, 15, 20 years?
That's a tough one, Dave. I wish I knew what it was going to be.
You see the outlines of it.
I wish I knew what it was going to be for 1990, but we do have some 1990 stuff going that is going to be more aerodynamic, not as severe in change from where we were to where we're going from today to there, but it's, I'd say, simpler forms, beautiful, smooth forms that are flowing, and faster windshields, shorter hoods, with the emphasis moved forward on the car for better aerodynamics, better stability, better package. The roofs are getting longer and stretched this way and not this way. And the bodies are being filled out more. We're going about the business now in a new manner. We're using the computers to help us get there quicker by taking our sketches and putting all that information right in the computer, and then we can then mill a clay model. We can also send the information to body engineering for them to check it. We can also get studies on weight, and we can get some aero estimates from our computers now rather than needing to wind tunnel everything. So we're moving rapidly into a new way of doing business. And we're also trying to, instead of doing a lot of various models and letting management come over and look and pick and choose and piece together, we're now trying to narrow this down earlier into the program so that we can get there with one or two good ones and end up with the decision almost as a flip of a coin, so you don't have to compromise.
So I wonder if we could elaborate on that a little bit. I think if future students of design would be most interested in how the technical aspects of design evolve from the earlier primitive days to the modern days of computer design. Could you bring us forward step by step you saw it in the industry?
The general ideas that all designers create on paper still have to be done by the designer on paper. Mm-hmm. He has to do his own thinking and come up with the initial design. But going from that into a larger scale and going from a sheet of paper into the three-dimensional model will now be done a lot easier by computer, because you can feed the points from your sketch or drawing onto the computer, and it will then take that and project it into a silhouette of a car that can be rotated and used as control points. So rather than starting your design in a big chunk of clay and then you have to then carve it out, you can now feed this to the computer, and the computer will then, in a sense, carve it out for you. And you can watch it and disagree with it and change it as it's doing it. It will also make corrections for you. If it sees you've got a bad line, it will fix it. Now, you have to be careful, because sometimes we put in bad lines purposely. But we're really into this, and it's looking like it's going to save us hours of time. And then the other single biggest factor is, once you've got the model created that you like, getting that information from the model back on paper is all done by computer now. And the draftsmen don't even draw it. It will scan the model, take its own points, put it on computer tape, and it will automatically draw a complete car in about a day's time, where it used to take weeks and weeks.
What has happened to the clay models? Are they beginning to feel the same impact that workers are on the robots?
The clay modelers are still needed, because you still have to prepare the clay. But what this machine does for you is it puts in its control lines. So then you don't have to then get the dimensions from a drawing and then you point them into the model. It does it for you automatically. So you then really become a clay modeler and not just a scale and a dimension taker, you know. So it the modelers are needed, but not as many. And we can do a clay car in a matter of 4 or 5 days.
Marvelous. You mentioned a wind tunnel. It's my recollection that Ford has never had a formal wind tunnel. You've had to contract it out over the years. Has that been a disadvantage?
That's true. It is a disadvantage. We test our cars in two dimensions. We test in 3/8 size, scale size, and we do those in two places, either in Maryland, University of Maryland, or in Texas. And then we also test full size at Lockheed in Georgia. And in all fairness, the full size test is really the one that counts, but the scale model tests are very, very close. They give you an awfully good indication of where you're at. So we can do a lot of scale model testing and know, geez, within just a tenth or two of where we're at. It is a disadvantage because to take a model and ship it, say, to Georgia, and the only way to get it there is by truck, and to leave it there for about a week and back again, you've lost a lot of time. And if we had one next door, like GM now has, we could do that on a weekend and lose no time at all.
I remember not too many years ago, there was a very concerted beginning for a wind tunnel, but it seemed to have the budget office got to it.
Well, our wind tunnel plans at the moment are now active again. We're going to have a wind tunnel, I guess, in about 3 years or so, but the original plans were discontinued for a couple reasons, mostly money. But I think now we're re-examining those plans. We're going to end up with a better tunnel. We're going to move it from its original site to another location, and I think it's going to be better. So maybe the delay was worth it. I don't know.
In terms of your career in design, what effect does design have on the public's buying habits? Are they pretty much influenced by what they see or by what they've been told by the advertising people?
Well, as a designer, I can't tell you anything, but they definitely have the biggest influence. It's really a total combination of a lot of factors. It has to be a good car. You can have the best design in the world, but if the car itself doesn't perform, doesn't drive, doesn't sit well, you don't sell too many. You can also take the best car in all those aspects. If it's ugly, it doesn't do well either. So I think it takes a lot of concentrated efforts of everybody to put together a total vehicle that's pleasing, is priced right. But we're of the opinion, and I believe very firmly, that you sell the car first by appearance. You've got to get them into the car, and you've got to get them to sit down before they can drive it. And I think cars are sold on the highway. And when you see one go by, you say, I think I like that car. I'm gonna go look at them. I'm going to buy one. You don't know at that stage whether it's got a good engine, a bad engine, rides good, handles good, or anything about it. So, yeah, I'm a firm believer that appearance is the number one biggest single factor. And I think during the days when we thought that we didn't have to change our vehicles from year to year, that they could last forever, some of the Japanese didn't change, some of the Europeans didn't change, we found that we couldn't live that way. So, and by the way, the Japanese are changing their cars more rapidly than we used to. They're changing their models in 6 months, some of them, so.
The aerodynamic look, which seems very fresh and appealing today, is not really a new concept in automobiles.
No, Chrysler did it way back in the, what, 23?
Well, they certainly came out
32 or something?
They certainly came out with the Airflow in the early 30s, right?
Yeah,
and,
right.
It got nowhere. And yet, I can remember that car as being probably the most exciting thing I'd seen on the streets in those days.
Well, I think in any new concept and design, you have to be very careful that you don't do too much too quick, good or bad. You can have the ultimate final solution that you're all going to achieve, get there, but you can't give it to the American public in one big giant step. Whether it goes boxes or whether it goes smooth aerodynamically or somewhere between that, you got to do it gracefully. And I think we did a better job of it this time than the Chrysler people did, and I think that there's a lot of good ways. By the way, GM is advertising aerodynamic cars now, and they don't look it, but their aero numbers aren't that bad. They've got those squared shapes pretty good. So you don't have to make them as round as we did to make them aero, but I think there's a lot of, what do I want to say? They almost have to look aero to be convinced they are aero. If they aren't and looks, you don't think you've got it.
In terms of design decisions, let me bring you back to a few years ago when you had the Tempo, or when you had the Thunderbird and the Cougar, and someone said, "Gee, we better hedge a bit on this. We'll let the Thunderbird go full blast, but we've got to do something to the Cougar in order to hedge our bets here." Is that a
well? It wasn't so much hedging the bet. I don't think that was the factor used. I think it was the fact that we wanted to get a greater difference between Lincoln Mercury Division and Ford Division. We also thought that the Lincoln Mercury buyer was a more formal buyer, that they're the ones that are probably walking from Chevrolet, or not from Chevrolet, but from GM, the Buick and the Olds and the Cadillac, over to Lincoln Mercury. And we needed a car that was something more familiar to them. And I think that was more of the reasoning than just to hedge a bet.
So it was a divisional.
Yeah, more divisional. Right now, it's surprising. Cougar's outselling Thunderbird.
Doing very well. Yeah. It was a very handsome car.
Yeah.
In terms of the aerodynamic look, organizationally, it sprang out of the European matrix. You probably sent some designers over there. I believe Jack Telnak was one.
Yes.
Who went over there to absorb the what was happening in the design studios there. Was that did that work out fairly well in terms of what came out of that?
Yeah, well, the Europeans have been doing aerodynamic shapes and forms for a long time because their gasoline prices are so high.
Right.
That they had to do that in order to help get better fuel economy. So they were somewhat forced into it through the years and knew, you know, quite a bit about it, what to do, what not to do, what's acceptable, what isn't acceptable. And yeah, in fact, sending a couple designers, we have sent just about all of our designers to Europe for some period. And yeah, it was very beneficial. We can almost design a car now from scratch, aerodynamically, without even sending it to the tunnel, and we can tell you about what it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a big learning curve. We probably ought to send some to Japan now, I think.
So pretty much the wave of the future at Ford and elsewhere is pretty much lower. More rounded.
Well, the biggest thing in the future now for cars is going to be package changing. We're going to end up with lower engines, lower frontal areas, lower cowls and instrument panels, faster and bigger windshields, a lot more glass, doors that wrap into the roof further for better entrance. We're going to be looking probably at more hatchbacks, bigger opening panels rather than small panels that open, bigger ones, whether they are decks or whatever they are. We're going to end up with bigger tires, treadier cars with a tread right out there, independent suspensions, and cars that have automatic leveling devices, and things that allow you to do all these things. You almost need to do that in order to control the car, to get the car down. And so those are the big things that make the designer's role exciting, and I guess gives us the opportunity to do better looking cars.
I wonder if I may throw a curve at you and just ask you in the next few minutes that we have left to comment on various people that you've encountered over the over the years. You came in '54. You probably ran into Frank Hershey at that point.
Sure did.
Can you tell me a bit about Frank Hershey?
I really didn't know Frank Hershey as well as
to Frank Hershey at that point.
Sure did.
Can you tell me a bit about Frank Hershey?
I really didn't know Frank Hershey as well as you would think, because I was a green designer right out of school, and when he left, I was still a green designer. But Frank, I thought, knew a lot about automobiles. He seemed to, as my standing along watching and listening, he seemed to have a perception about cars at that time that some of the others didn't have. Then I found out that he was an antique collector, and then I kind of realized why. But he was a Christian Scientist, I remember that. He lost a daughter because of it. He did not get along with management that well. He was a very argumentative manager, and I don't believe too well liked.
And left after, very shortly after this, I believe.
I believe so, yeah.
I'd like you to spend some time, I'd like to have you spend some time on Eugene Bourdonnais, who apparently was a very seminal figure in the 50s, late 50s, 60s.
I'll talk about Gene. To begin with, Mr. Bourdonnais hired me. I did not deal that close with him for a long period of time. When I came into the company, I was at one end and he was at the other. But at the end of his career, I probably spent more time with Bourdonnais than any other single individual. And we spent and planned and designed a lot of cars together in his office or mine on the table over a cup of coffee. He is, I think, one of the best commercial designers living. He stood for what he thought and argued for it and about people. I think that because of Gene and his efforts, we would not have had Marx, and we would not have had Versailles, we would not have had two-door Lincolns, a lot of car lines, by the way, that without his input in the planning and design stage, the company would not have had. And I think he is probably never given that credit.
In effect, he modernized the design studio at Ford.
Yes.
Brought it forward out of the dark ages.
Absolutely, yeah. Right. He, as you mentioned, he organized it to do the job. And I don't think he over-organized it. I think he organized it pretty well. He brought in an engineering staff to work with the designers so that we weren't out playing in the clay without knowing where we were, what we were doing. I used him as a sounding board through my career. You could talk to Gene and get a straight answer. And I felt very comfortable and I feel very highly with him, about him.
He seems to have brought in most of the creative people that are still going strong today, like yourself and others.
Yes.
So you could probably credit him with much of the direction that the styling, the design center is taking in recent years.
Yeah, I think Gene had a very keen sense for talent. I used to remember, and we used to witness walking around in the studios, that I had my opinion about people and who was really doing the job and who was either not that qualified, and he would talk to sometimes the non-qualified, and I'd say later, I didn't realize you liked that guy that well. And he'd say, oh, he's a nice guy to talk to, but he isn't worth a damn on the job. But I really think without Gene, the Design Center would not be near what it is. Mm-hmm. He probably didn't get the credit he deserves.
There were some fascinating characters as you came in.
You're going to mention those now?
Yeah, Joe Oros fascinates me quite a bit.
Well, I worked for Joe for years. Joe is probably the hardest working designer that Ford Motor Company ever had. He, I would say, is the Lawrence Welk of the design business. And he didn't design the frills. He didn't design the... He just was a good commercial designer. He probably designed more cars for Ford than any other single person.
Tough to work for, I understand.
Easy if you could work with him, yeah. I had no trouble with Joe, but...
Why did Joe leave? He seemed to be a fairly solid person.
His thinking and the company thinking kind of went that way. And they sent him to Europe, which was a mistake. He is absolutely the worst person they could have sent to Europe, because he doesn't think any more European than anybody. And he really was a fish out of water in Europe. And they realized that and sent him back, and they didn't have any place for him. And it was too bad. But here again, see, the people who he worked with, which was the Ernie Breeches and the George Walkers, and that era were gone. So it was tough.
How about Elwood Engel? Did you work with him at all?
I worked with Elwood very well. Mm-hmm. Long time. Elwood is probably one of the most talented designers, but a real character. A real playboy. He played as hard as he worked. And he worked very, he did, he worked very hard. Mm-hmm. But he would think nothing of stopping and getting everybody together and pitch coins to the wall, or he did this purposely to relax the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. I believe it. Mm-hmm. And then he'd say, okay guys, get back to work. But to a lot, that was kind of a playboy image, but he really was thinking all the time.
What were his contributions? Can you remember?
He worked on a lot of Mercurys.
Did he?
And he worked on the very first, in fact, designed the very first Lincoln or Continental that had the grill that was like this, the very in the blade sides.
Mm-hmm.
That's Elwood.
Mm-hmm.
Good?
Yes.
He's in very bad shape, by the way.
I'm sorry to hear that. John Najar, a surreal old-timer who has survived almost to the present day.
John is an old friend of mine, one of my early bosses. John is probably not as good a designer, but a very good manager. He managed very well. He was always trying to do something a little tricky in design by creating a mirror or doing something that was kind of a little bit tricky. So if you could get John to work on the other aspect but leave the appearance and the aesthetics to somebody else, it would have made a great team.
Mm-hmm.
John was a, if you organized a team, you'd want him on it. But you really wouldn't want him sketching the theme. But John ended up working for me and Truck when he left. And
I understand that, yeah. You and he were working on the Ranger then.
Yeah. And I used him exactly for that.
Good.
There was nobody better you could send to an engineering meeting than John.
And that was important.
Oh, yeah.
Because you had to convince the engineers.
Oh, yeah. Because he thought like they thought he was one of them. And it just went just great.
That's marvelous.
Yeah.
He tells me, and I think you've told this elsewhere, that he that his fondness for the P-51 airplane was the inspiration for the naming the Mustang, or at least proposing.
I think it's true.
Yeah, right.
I believe that's true, because the name for the Mustang was originally Cougar, you know that?
Right, yeah, that was the code word, right. Another fascinating character from this area is Bob McGuire. Do you remember him at all?
Oh, yeah, very well. Bob, as you probably know, is Ken Spencer's uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very much alike. McGuire, I think, was in his day a very talented designer, had very good design feel and sense. He was disliked by a lot of people because he didn't communicate very well. He was above that or something. But he did a lot for Ford.
What were his accomplishments?
Well, he worked on the 57 Ford.
Mm-hmm.
59s, I believe, through that era in the late 50s, or late 50s, early 60s.
He worked with you on those.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In fact, McGuire, I think, was one of my early sponsors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he's well thought of by most of the people we've talked to. Yeah. Alex Tremulous. What can you tell me about
Alex? I told you about Alex.
Tell me again.
Well, Alex is probably an old-time enthusiastic car nut. He worked for, I think, just about every company, including Duesenberg and Crosley and some that, there are a lot of them that aren't in existence. I think he knows the ins and outs of design as well as anybody, but he personally never really did it.
Mm.
He was always on the outskirts of it and stood around and did the talking while somebody else was doing the working.
The outer limits.
No, he's an outer limits designer, but he is a charming guy. And if you've never met him, but he'll charm you to death. And you'll thoroughly enjoy him.
Good.
I don't think he's a great designer personally, but when I learned to know him, he was maybe past his day.
Mm-hmm. You had come in on just the tail end of George Walker. Did you get to know him?
Yes, I knew George.
Well?
Yeah.
What sort of person was he in the latter stages of his career? Before?
Well, George, I think, was basically a PR man.
Mm-hmm.
He did the company a lot of good. I think he did what he was needed to do at the time. He came in, he organized the design group and the design center. He put us, gave us stature, which we didn't have at that time.
The first VP of design.
First VP. He demanded and got a lot of things that we needed. As a designer, I don't think he was worth a darn, but I think he was so political, he would walk around and ask people who he had respect for, mm-hmm. what do you think and what do you like, and then he'd recommend what they said. He would only copy what they said. Mm-hmm. But I think he did a job. Mm-hmm. He's still living in Arizona.
We hope to interview him this summer.
Good.
Don De La Rosa, you worked with him for over several years. What were your impressions of his accomplishments?
Don is a fantastic designer. Well, the most talented of anybody you could ask about. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Don's talent, his talent really kept him going, because he was probably a lousy manager, a poor manager. He couldn't seem to get things organized. He, as you know, had a serious drinking problem.
He's probably the first to admit it.
Oh yeah, I think he'd admit that. You ought to talk to him.
Yeah, we hope to.
And he is a delightful guy to talk to. Mm-hmm. And one of the guys who, when you're really in trouble, you go to Don, because he can design you out of it. He's that good.
What were his contributions over the years?
Oh gosh, he worked on a lot of Mercurys. And he and I designed a Falcon. The first Falcon together.
Oh, you haven't told me that.
I didn't tell you that, did I?
Yes.
And we did that downstairs in the garage.
You've got time. Tell us a bit about that. That's fascinating.
Well, we couldn't get, at the time when the company was trying to develop a Falcon, they couldn't get a design. It was one of those that just couldn't get it to be acceptable. Mm-hmm. So Bordenay said, we just got to form a task force. And I'm going to form two. I want one headed up by Bob McGuire and one by De La Rosa. And each of them had three designers and a crew of clay modelers. And I was the lead guy for De La Rosa. And because the building was all full, we had to go down in the basement in the garage.
Huh?
And we set up a bridge, and we had a car down there. And we designed the car that eventually had that sculpture on the side and the round taillight on the back. Mm-hmm. That's the car we did together. And I got a lot of respect for Don. I like him. I think that he's one of the premier designers of our time in automobiles. He just unfortunately wrecked his life a little bit.
Was he an Iacocca man?
Yes, very much.
Yeah.
Very much.
He has joined him since that day, right?
Yep. Yeah. I turned that job down, by the way.
Did you? How did that come about?
I shouldn't tell you.
Go ahead.
I was offered that job before Del Rosa took it.
Really? How'd it come about?
I don't know.
Iacocca
remembered me.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you decided not to take it?
Well, the timing was bad. Mm-hmm. One thing, the company at the time looked like it was going to go under any minute. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to pay me anything.
Mm-hmm.
It at the time looked like one big risk.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, Don had retired from Ford. It was ideal.
Mm-hmm. Perfect for him.
So I even recommended it to get him.
Good.
Then there was no budget to work with.
Mm-hmm. Had he worked with Sperlich before?
Yes, and they didn't get along.
Oh, that's interesting.
No, Hal Sperlich did not like De La Rosa. Mm-hmm. Because of a lot of reasons, but I'm surprised that I guess they're getting along now. But
apparently,
yeah.
A minor but entertaining figure in the design pantheon, Roy Brown. Did you work with him?
I never worked for him, but he worked for me, Roy. Is an artist. He's probably one of the best artists, along with Homer Lagasse, of anybody going. He spends a lot of time now doing paintings and beautiful stuff. He is, again, I think, a weak designer, but a tremendous PR guy. Now, if you lined up all the guys and said, pick out the artist, you'd pick Roy because he looks like an artist. and he talks good, mm-hmm. and he can tell you all about it. But when he was working for me in the Ford studio, he did the managing and I did the designing. So.
How about Homer Lugassi?
Well, Homer again is a little bit like Roy. Mm-hmm. Very talented, extremely good at working with people. And by the way, Roy is too. They can work and organize and get the troops all churned up about it and so forth. But as far as coming up with a design that's usable and something you could pick that would be a commercial design, neither one, I think, especially Homer, can do that for you.
Mm-hmm. What were his accomplishments?
Homer worked at Chrysler. And he was in charge of Plymouth Studio, and I forget what all, Chrysler, when they were doing cars in the early 50s. Those were his designs. Some of those that had the flying front fenders, and of those, mm-hmm. the taillights that went off. Some of that, those were his designs. He was still doing them over here.
Now, he's at the Center for Creative Designs in Detroit.
Doing a terrific job. Mm-hmm. He really is.
Yeah. Speaking of centers for creative design, what about the Pasadena studio, and how did that evolve, and how did that come to be a center for almost all the industries?
Well, I think it was organized by a man by the name of Adams, who had the philosophy that in order to be able to teach art correctly for the industry, you had to have somebody in the industry teaching it. Mm-hmm. So he organized a school in a little house or a house out there, and he invited people in various areas of design and photography to come in and teach part-time, a day or two a week or evenings or whatever, and that's the way the school got started. And so therefore, over a period of years, their students were better qualified for the jobs than any of the colleges or universities, because those were being taught by professors that were never in the business. And
kind of quite influential.
Oh yeah. Well, Art Center really set the pattern, and now Creative Studies and Cleveland and other art schools are following suit. They're all their classes are being taught now by people in the business. So,
and the industry has pretty much moved westward in terms of design theory. Have not almost everyone established a center out there to be near?
Well, there's a mystique that says that all trends begin in California and move east. Now, I think there's a little truth in that, but I think a lot of it is mystique. I'm not so sure that just because our coast is closer to Japan that the cars were unloaded there. I do believe, because of their climate, that they can have a freer lifestyle and they can go to the beach and they can wear shorts the year round. And, you know, I think that is a lot of the mystique. But I don't believe that they're as far advanced as most people think. Some people say as much as 2 to 5 years. I would say that there may be a year or so doing things that eventually come this way. But.
And yet the companies have established a so-called center. In each.
Well, let me tell you why. In my opinion, it's because the Japanese have sold so many cars there that people back here think, my gosh, we must be missing something because we can't sell our cars out there. So there's something about California that we don't know. That they think different, they work differently, they dress differently. So we better get some cars designed there by Californians for California. I think we have to wait and see what happens. I think it's a little bit.
Instead, GM is moving its sign back to the tech center.
From California?
Yeah.
Oh, are they?
That's what I've heard, yeah. At least portions of it, yeah.
I had not heard that. I heard the other way around. I heard they had their design center and they were moving their West Coast sales office in the same building. Mm-hmm. So they had one big tech center out there.
Mm-hmm. I'll check that for sure.
Okay.
Bill Schmidt, did you work with him at all when you first came to Ford?
I didn't work with Bill when I came to Ford, but I've learned to know Bill in the years since, and I've dealt with him recently. Bill is a very articulate, easy-spoken, super nice guy. I think a little overrated in his ability. He came in and wanted to do some Mustang work for us, and we agreed to let him do it. And he brought in a car or two a couple times that were really not that good. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't even, when we showed them to management, they kind of laughed at him. Mm-hmm. Part of that could be because he's been out of it. But here again, I think a guy who was really a super nice guy, but a little bit weak in design. Mm-hmm. And I think you got to watch that in these people, you know. Mm-hmm. But I like Bill. He's doing a lot of outside work here in Detroit.
Is he? Yep. Still in the business?
Yeah, he'd be a good guy to talk to, by the way.
Yes, we're hoping.
Can give you a good insight, because he left Ford and went to Packard, I believe. Left Packard and went to Chrysler. Mm-hmm. And he went to Chrysler in a funny way. He took on a design program, and he did it on the outside. He hired some empty supermarkets. And the contract read that if he sold his designs, he took over design. If he didn't, they kept who they had.
Oh,
and
he
won.
It worked.
Now, he had some good people.
Mm-hmm. Another name which pops up, and probably it would be close to your area, would be Art Corfeld. What can you tell us about him and his career?
Art is probably a very heavy contributor to the Ford cars. He did probably all the interiors for years and years, and no one's worked harder than Art has. And his only fault, I believe, in his later years was he didn't shift. He didn't change, and he wasn't willing to shift off of the old patterns into the new thinking as well. And I think that was one of his problems. And I'm not so sure he was totally wrong, but in this business, you got to be very flexible.
Interiors changed not as radically, but...
Well, they are.
Are they?
Yeah.
They are now, but I mean, yeah. the change in the 70s and the early 80s were fairly
Well, things are going like from velours to more like knits and wools and different kinds of fabrics and different kinds of seating. And Art was very reluctant to change, you know. And he just thought that this was junk and he couldn't believe it. But he really worked hard and deserves everything he got. I like him.
Good. Another fascinating character from this era, from the era in which you came on, Bill Boyer. Did you work with Bill quite a bit?
Yeah, Bill works for me today.
He does, in the truck
design. In the truck area. Mm-hmm. Bill is probably credited for doing most of the Thunderbird designs through the years, or at least had the responsibility. And Bill is a very talented designer, very low-key guy, soft-spoken, does as he's told, doesn't create waves, nice, reliable guy.
And a good man to have on the
staff. Oh yeah, good man on the staff, yeah.
In terms of cross-pollinization within the industry, did you Did design direction and theory complemented by what was going on in other segments of the industry? Take a man like Gordon Burig or later his later successors at General Motors. Did you and your opposite or your counterparts at Ford were you much interested in what was going on at the other company?
Well, we always are, and we still are. But as from a designer standpoint, I guess we are as interested in what's going on as, say, the product planners are, and maybe the top management from an investment standpoint. They don't want to be spending a lot of money on the wrong product and be completely off base. And let's face it, GM sets the trend mostly. If they're going one way and we find we're going the opposite, once in a while that's good for us, but most of the time it isn't. So we watch it from that standpoint. And we're interested too, don't get me wrong, but we're not as keen on trying to copy or follow. I personally don't believe in following. I like to do my own thinking and try to do it my way and not just copy the Europeans or the GM guys. And I think right now we're leading. I think that Ford Motor Company has the newest, freshest, and will become the most copied stuff on the road. And it's just going to take a couple years to do it. I think at GM their philosophy is different, but they have a much restrained group leading the company, and they're more timid about changing their cars. They do it slower. But once in a while they let you know that they're pretty good when they do Firebirds and Camaros and Corvettes and Fieros and some of those. So they tell you occasionally that we're still the best, but we're a little bit timid in the Cadillacs and the Buicks. So.
The design by committee, or I mean the committee approach to General Motors, it makes it a little less flexible, does it not?
Well, design by committee always does.
Yes.
When Iacocca was at Ford, it was really just designed for Iacocca, and I'm sure that's in spades at Chrysler. We have a design by committee at Ford more than you believe. We have too many channels, you got to walk it through. Too many product planning groups, too many committees. Better than I think it used to be, though. But I think at GM it may be even more horrendous. And maybe that's why that they're a little bit slow. Yeah. And I'm not so sure they're right or wrong yet.
It remains to be seen. I'd like very much for you to sort of relax and tell us a little bit about your thoughts about Henry Ford II. Obviously, the key figure in all this. What influence he had on design decisions? How his decisions affected the final product?
Well, he, in my communication with Mr. Ford, he really never caused any problem unless he saw something he absolutely didn't like. And then he would say so, and you would very rapidly change it. And he never forgot. There's one thing about Mr. Ford is if he saw something once that he didn't like, or something that he really did like, the next time he was over, he would remember that. But I've never hardly ever seen him really voice a strong opinion about design per se. A program, yes, or some other factor, but not too much on design. He had an opinion, but no more so than anybody else.
You you think part of this was due to the fact that he trusted Jean Bourdonnais' judgment during this period?
Very much. I think very, very much.
And that they seem to have a certain rapport.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And a certain similar way of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I think Jean designed cars that Mr. Ford was comfortable with.
However, there was a point in the mid to late 70s where Henry Ford II seemed a bit out of step with the times. Was there an uncomfortable, awkward period there?
I think that he was going through a bad period in his life. Mm-hmm. I think that he was not completely happy with his management. Mm-hmm. He was not happy at home or his marriage. And it seems like he tires of management as fast as he does his wife. And if I were to fault Mr. Ford, I think that's one thing I'd fault him on, is that, you know, he never really gave his Bucky Knutsons and the Iacocas and those guys a fair run at it. And the minute I really believe that he thought that they were becoming too powerful, he took them away. When they really, he let them get to their role to do their job only to a point. And he watched that point very carefully. And that was very unfortunate.
The interim management, in terms of Philip Caldwell, has stabilized things nicely. But you've got an exciting period ahead with Harold Red Poling and to a lesser extent, Gene Peterson.
Or whoever else.
Or whoever else is coming up on a fast track. How does it look in terms of management? How will management impact on design decisions in the next couple of decades?
Well, that's a tough question, Dave. I think that Poling, for example, is not a designer by a long shot. Mm. One good thing about him is he just admits that he's not an engineer, or he's not really that involved, and he leaves that to somebody else. He does voice an opinion when he feels strongly, or if he sees something he doesn't like, a little bit of the Mr. Ford thing, and he'll say so. But most of the time in meetings, Red doesn't say much. He just sort of stands there and listens and leaves, you know.
What has been his strong points?
Well, he's a finance man. He's a bottom line, get return on the product, and that's the key thing. And he works at it hard, and it makes it work. I feel that there's in the future of Ford Motor Company, a potential problem, and I shouldn't say this on tape, but of the grandchildren coming up. That I think in the next 10 years there could be a tremendous Ford family fight take place between Bill and Edsel and who else do we have?
Benson,
and then there's another one. Josephine's boy.
He seems to be pretty much out of it at the moment.
And I don't believe that they're going to be as amenable to let one of them go to the top. As easily as Bill did and Benson did with Henry.
With Henry, as the eldest son.
Because I understand that was a family agreement. Mother dictated that.
Right.
And I think that that's going to be a big problem in the company. I really do.
Both Edsel and Bill Jr. seem to have some promise in terms of development. And
yep.
And
yeah, very much so.
Very much so. Mm-hmm. Do you see William Clay moving into a more bigger role in company affairs at this point? Is he still vice chairman, by the way?
Yeah, I think he's a dark horse. I think if Caldwell retires and there's a problem, I think Mr. Ford likes Poling very much, but that's going to create a disaster. Bill could become a temporary, or could fill that job for a short period of time and smooth things out. It's a logical move. Maybe Poling becomes president and Bill or Peterson becomes vice chairman or something, mm-hmm. and everything would go tick, tick, tick.
And Bill would be chairman.
Yeah.
Yes.
Peterson then would act as chairman, mm-hmm. kind of, you know.
Right.
But I don't know what's going to happen. I really don't.
In terms of a product, is the line going to is the product line going to expand in terms of a variety of, or are you really contracting a bit in the next 10 years?
Well, let me tell you, the plans are to contract, mm-hmm. but the plans at the moment are expanding.
Uh-huh.
We are keeping all the cars alive, and we're facelifting and bringing out new versions of the ones that we plan to drop next year. So we're in a dilemma as far as really following our 10-year plan is to get smaller and aim with a rifle instead of a shotgun.
So there's been a temporary dislocation in that plan, but eventually, perhaps in the next 2-3 years, you'll be able to get back on track.
I don't think we will, Dave, until like 1990.
Really? It'll take that long?
Yeah.
What have been the factors in that derailment?
I think two big things: gasoline price,
mm-hmm.
economy.
Mm-hmm. Everything's bounced back.
Everything's bounced back. People don't want to drive little cars like we thought they did.
Mm-hmm.
They still want the big Lincolns. They still want the luxury big Fords and Mercurys. I think it's just been a turnaround in the economy that no one forecasted. So a lot of these good plans that were all in place are now getting either set aside temporarily or tumbled, you know.
So. But eventually, as the decade ends, you'll be back in that area that you envisioned about 3 or 4 years ago. That you'll be,
but you'll probably have a, different.
You'll have a small, compact.
I think we'll end up probably changing our plans and combining from somewhere within everything we've got. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is a clear-cut direction at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't.
That makes an exciting time for you, I suspect.
Exciting, but a little bit hazy, a little bit confusing. Yeah. But we have a lot of things going, honest to gosh. Boy.
Well, there certainly is a Ford in your future.
You think so? I hope so. I don't know.
You don't look like you're a man that's going to retire next year.
No, I don't think so.
Well, we've been speaking to Gail L. Halderman, who is the, as of today, is the Small Car Exteriors and Truck Design Executive. And we thank you very much, Gail, for sharing your reminiscences with us.
Good.